And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We will spend the next few minutes of WGTD's morning shows talking about expectations, the expectations that we have about ourselves and our lives and the world around us, and the profound influence that our expectations can have over how we feel, what we achieve in the world, how we view the world and each other. I'm talking today to the author of a brand new book called The Expectation Effect, How Your Mindset Can Change Your World. The author of the book is David Rupson, an award-winning science writer based in Great Britain, a graduate of Cambridge University, a former editor of New Scientist, and a former senior journalist with the BBC, and the author of a previous international bestseller called The Intelligence Trap. And again, this latest book published by Henry Holt & Company is titled The Expectation Effect. David Rupson, we welcome you to the morning show.
It's absolutely my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I'm really excited to speak with you. And I must say, your book exceeded my expectations, speaking of expectations, in the sense that I tend to be both skeptical of and kind of weary of books that sort of look like this at a glance. A lot of self-help books, and you touch on this actually, I think, in the prologue of the book, that a lot of books have been written that sort of say the same thing and yet not at all the same thing. And I wonder if you felt any wariness in terms of putting this book together, knowing that there are a whole lot of self-help books out there that sort of bear some resemblance to them. And how careful were you to write a book that would be distinct and especially more scientifically grounded than many other such books?
Yeah, I mean, I was really wary that this book would be confused with the other kind of positive thinking literature that's out there. You know, I think we have this intuition that our thoughts can shape our reality, and it's not, you know, it's not wrong, that intuition. But what I think the other books about positive thinking have done is really they've tried to promote this kind of vague optimism, just this idea that if you kind of visualize yourself being healthy and happy and rich, that will automatically come to you through this kind of power of attraction. That's really not what the expectation effect is about at all. What I've done there is to look at the scientific literature through hundreds of really robust experiments to kind of put the boundary conditions on kind of when do our expectations shape our well-being, when don't they, and how can we apply that within our lives practically. And really what I found actually is that that, you know, you can apply the expectation effect without becoming this kind of Pollyanna-ish kind of optimist. It's actually very much about changing your specific expectations to specific events or specific challenges. And often there are very easy ways to do that honestly without any kind of self-deception. Mm. And the science shows that it can have real effects on our well-being through changes to our behavior, our perception, but also our physiology. So it's all very much scientifically grounded.
Right. And that is a distinction that's, I think, really important to acknowledge and appreciate. At the front of your book, you do indeed name specifically that book titled The Secret by Rhonda Burns. And I so vividly remember when much of the country and I myself to some extent got caught up in something that Oprah Winfrey helped kind of foster, the all kinds of anticipation about what this exciting new book was going to be and what is The Secret. And my word, I felt so gypped, and I almost feel like Oprah Winfrey should be divested of every award she's ever gotten, you know, just because of fostering attention for this book that, you know, I for one just found not only kind of worthless, but potentially really harmful when you think about the way it set up a lot of unsuspecting people for tremendous disappointment and failure by proposing that, yeah, as you were saying, just kind of thinking positively will lead to all of these positive things happening to you. That's not helpful to anybody, I shouldn't think.
No, exactly. I think that's really the important thing to remember, that with the expectation effect, mostly I'm just asking people to kind of reinterpret events in a way that is totally honest. It's not kind of having this inflated perception of what you can achieve, but it's actually just looking at the facts and trying to work out when actually you're being overly negative. And I think that's the key thing here, is that actually often our expectations are just overly negative, or we kind of suffer from this catastrophic thinking. We assume that things are going to get much worse than they really are. And actually what I'm just asking people to do is to reframe their expectations so they avoid that kind of thinking, and actually they just look at the situation a bit more objectively. And I think one of the best examples I could give from that is when I talk about people's attitudes to stress. Now, most people, I think, see stress as this kind of wholly negative, debilitating thing. You know, when we feel anxious before an exam or a job interview or doing public speaking, we assume that the anxiety itself is going to harm our performance and that it's bad for us, it's bad for our bodies. Now, one way to deal with that is to try to suppress the feeling, but that's just really hard to do. You know, the study showed that actually if you just try to suppress a feeling, and to tell yourself to be calm, that that's actually going to backfire. And, you know, I think that's the kind of approach that actually something like The Secret would tell you to do. It's just like, just ignore it and tell yourself it's going to be brilliant. Well, that's not going to happen. But what with the expectation effect we find is that you can actually just shift your mindset so you reinterpret the feelings. So you actually completely accept that you're having all of these kind of different symptoms to your body, you know, the racing heart and the kind of sweating palms, but you start to kind of ask yourself, well, what, you know, why did the body evolve to have that response? And the answer is it evolved because the anxiety response is actually adaptive. So when the heart is beating really hard, that's actually pumping oxygen to your brain, which can sharpen your thinking. Similarly, the hormones that we associate with stress at moderate levels can actually be really good for your thinking. They can keep you on the ball, keep you on your toes. We know that with things like cortisol, that actually, you know, you need like a certain level of cortisol to really to be sharp. And what the scientists found was that actually just changing that interpretation, so the people aren't denying their feelings, but they're just changing how they interpret those feelings, that can be really beneficial. It can improve the performance in those big challenges like public speaking or taking a difficult exam. But also it can do things like change the way they recover from the stress afterwards. So once you've reinterpreted your feelings like that and you're not kind of telling yourself that that stress was really bad for you, you actually just recover a lot more quickly. So your body just returns to normal within an hour, say, rather than still feeling kind of really charged up and unpleasant for the rest of the evening. So that can be really powerful in the short term and in the long term.
Mm. Yeah, I think you've said it really well. It is not about a rose-colored glasses sort of blanket of optimism over everything. It's about, in a sense, owning and understanding your own feelings and understanding their role that they play, both positive and negative. And I think you explore that so very, very well. When you make mention of that other book, Rhonda Byrne's is The Secret, that's the last time we'll mention the title of that book, I promise. But you very clearly and I think rightly call it pure pseudoscience. And it's probably important for us to underscore the fact that you are a science writer and that everything that you are writing about in this book is based on scientific information, scientific data garnered through really careful scientific study. And that's probably a distinction that we should not leave unsaid or underemphasized.
No, absolutely. And, you know, yeah, like I've cited something like 450 of these really high-quality studies, and I've tried to make sure that they've been replicated too. So I'm really looking at, you know, a huge body of evidence all pointing to the same conclusions. To go back to, like, The Secret, you know, that does sometimes try to cite kind of scientific evidence, but, you know, it's not really reflecting the way the scientists themselves see the studies. You know, it's using scientific terms but misapplying them. That's not what I'm doing at all, because, you know, I've got 15 years experience covering science responsibly. So I'm really, you know, trying to kind of demonstrate accurately what's happening in the mind and how that is affecting things like the body and our behavior.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with science writer David Robson about his latest book, which is called The Expectation Effect, How Your Mindset Can Change Your World. Mr. Robson, you do mention early on in the book that that this study, this interest, is in part deeply personal. That is, that some of your interest in it springs from a particular moment in your own life, and it was a moment of some difficulty. Explain to our listeners what I'm talking about.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So, you know, I guess I've had an interest in the expectation effect for a long time, and, you know, throughout my career as a science writer, I've covered the placebo effect in medicine. So that's, I think that's fairly well known now, but that's when you kind of expect a treatment to be effective, that often it can make the treatment more effective, even if you're receiving something like a dummy pill, like a sugar pill. You can sometimes see physiological benefits to that, you know, a reduction in inflammation in the body, an increase in certain neurotransmitters. So I kind of knew for a long time that expectations could be powerful, but I really experienced this myself when I was experiencing a period of depression in my life, and I was prescribed some, you know, very standard antidepressant pills, and my doctor just happened to tell me that, as all doctors should do, that they could come with some side effects. And one of the side effects was migraines, which she said were fairly common for people taking these pills. And, you know, so I started taking them, and they did improve my mood. But I did also find that I suffered from really terrible migraines. You know, it felt really very difficult to work. It was, you know, like such a sharp pain, almost like a kind of ice pick penetrating the skull, you know. And it was just really lucky that at the time I was writing a journalistic article that was looking at not just the placebo effect, but the kind of evil twin of the placebo effect, which is called the nocebo effect. And that is when a doctor's warnings can cause you to become ill through a negative expectation effect. So it's really the opposite of the placebo effect. And we now know that that can also be linked to physiological change, so that if people are told they're going to experience a headache, they often will experience a headache, and that's associated with changes to the vasculature of the brain, you know, kind of dilated blood vessels that kind of cause the feeling of pressure. Now, it was just really fortuitous that I was writing that article at the same time as experiencing these side effects, because I went to the scientific literature, and I found that actually the migraines that lots of people experience when they're taking this particular kind of antidepressant pill seemed to be caused by a nocebo effect. They seem to be caused by expectation. We know that because you can look at the clinical trials and you can see that people who are taking a dummy pill believing it to be the antidepressant, when they're told that they will experience that side effect, they often do, even though they're not taking an active drug. Mm. So I could be fairly certain from that the headaches that I was experiencing weren't caused by any kind of chemical action within my brain triggered by the drug itself, but it was caused by my expectations. And that realization alone was really powerful in relieving the pain. So I kind of read that paper in the morning, went out for lunch, and by the time I left work at the end of the day, the headache had almost completely vanished and it never really came back. And that was just so powerful for me to show that just how our expectations can shape our well-being, and how, you know, that pain was absolutely real to me. And it, you know, probably was caused by physiological change as well. It wasn't imagined. It was like very important for my well-being. And I just started to become fascinated then by, you know, lots of other expectation effects beyond the placebo effect and beyond the nocebo effect. So I started looking into how our expectations can shape our fitness and diet and aging. And, you know, a couple of years later, after I'd gathered all of this evidence, it really became obvious to me that actually there's a huge story to tell here about how important our expectations can be for all areas of health and well-being.
Right. And it's important for this story to be told in a way that is clear and soundly based in science versus told in another way that's much more careless. In this portion of the book where you talk about your own direct and personal encounter with the placebo and nocebo effect, you then cite in fairly brief fashion, but it really attracts our interest, how there are studies that, for instance, talk about sleep or that talk about aging, in which we see this same kind of very tangible and really unmistakable effect of our expectations. Can you just touch briefly on both of these areas that you talk about in this chapter?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so the sleep studies, again, were, you know, when I discovered those, that really spoke to me because, you know, I know a lot of people who kind of suffer from, basically one spouse will say that they suffer from bad insomnia and the other spouse is very skeptical of that. And what I discovered is that actually, like, some of the effects that people have from alleged insomnia might actually be an expectation effect. And so what this research has shown is that when you get people into the sleep labs and ask them to, you know, just go to sleep as normal and you record their brain activity, is that people are really bad at estimating how much they sleep. And it doesn't correlate very well with the objective measures of sleep. But that those expectations then shape their well-being for the following day. So if people are complaining good sleepers, they get a full 8 hours sleep with no problems. But because they have this perception that they've slept badly, you know, maybe they woke up once in the night for a very short period of time, but they assume that they were laying awake for ages, that when they have that negative belief, they're more likely to suffer from poor concentration, high levels of fatigue, you know, kind of difficulty in controlling their moods, all of the things we associate with sleep loss. And conversely, you get people who non-complaining bad sleepers. So they do have fairly disturbed nights, but they actually suffer none of the effects of insomnia that we would normally associate with sleep loss. They, you know, maintain their concentration well. You know, that's really telling evidence, and then scientists have gone further. They've invited people into the lab, and they've given them sham feedback. So they've actually manipulated people's expectations. They've told, you know, some people, you're a fantastic sleeper, and others, you know, like there's really something, you know, like very weak in your sleep, like you're constantly waking up in the night, even if you don't realize it. And those, they found that actually manipulating people's expectations in that way could have an effect then on their daytime functioning. So the link there is very strong, in my opinion, and it's something we should all consider. You know, whenever we kind of feel that we've had a bad night, I think it's really useful just to question, like, you know, do I have really good reason to think that, or might I be exaggerating and catastrophizing just a relatively small disturbance in my sleep?
Mm. At one point in that chapter of the book, you say, essentially, we slept as well as we think we did. I mean,
yeah,
thinking
exactly.
We slept well is really as useful and beneficial as actually sleeping well or physically or medically sleeping well, which is really intriguing. You also touch on the profound effect on the aging process when it comes to expectations. Just touch briefly on this summary, which is explored much more deeply later in the book.
Yeah, I mean, the research on aging is just phenomenal from my perspective. You know, it really blew my mind. So it's now kind of, you know, the body of research on the effects of expectations on aging has been building for 20 years, so it's very robust. But the first study that really caught people's attention measured people's beliefs about aging in midlife, so before they had actually started to experience any age-related decline, really. It just asked people, like, what do you expect in the decades ahead? Do you think things are going to get better or worse? Do you associate it with vulnerability? And what they found was that those expectations shaped how long those people lived. So by about 7.5 years, if you have positive beliefs about aging, you're more likely to live for 7.5 years longer than people who have the negative expectations. There's been a huge amount of research since, like really kind of joining the dots and explaining why that happens. And it all comes down to really changes in behavior. So if you have a kind of negative, defeatist attitude to aging, you're less likely to take care of your body with exercise and a good diet, and that's going to have an effect on your health. But there's also a kind of direct psychosomatic route as well to this. And essentially, if you assume that you're aging, that aging comes with vulnerability, every little challenge in your life is going to feel a bit more dangerous, a bit more difficult, a bit more stressful. So you're going to see like the kind of much more extreme spikes in the stress hormones, higher levels of inflammation within the body, all these things that causes wear and tear on tissues in the long term. And then we see that those effects can actually be traced down to kind of changes within the cells themselves. So you have all of these changes in gene expression and changes to the protective caps on the ends of people's chromosomes that seem to be associated with their age beliefs through this kind of heightened stress response. So I think the mechanism here is now very well understood, and it's really astonishing and something that we should all be considering. Whatever our age, actually, it's really important to try to change our age beliefs to be more positive, because the effects build up over decades. So even someone in their 30s are kind of laying the foundations for either good or bad aging, the effects of which will be seen decades later.
We're speaking with David Robson about his book called The Expectation Effect, How Your Mindset Can Change Your World. One thing that will, I think, not be very familiar to people before they read your book is what you term a revolutionary new theory concerning the brain. And evidently you think it is very helpful for us in kind of accessing and better understanding some of what we've already touched on that will feel a little more familiar to people. You think it's important for us at the outset to have an understanding of our brain, the human brain, as a prediction machine, that constantly simulates the future. Explain a little further what is behind this notion of the brain as a prediction machine and why it is so crucial for us to have that understanding of the brain in terms of understanding everything else you're talking about in the expectation effect.
So this idea has been around for, at least 150 years. It started out as a kind of philosophical understanding of the brain, but then in the last 20 years or 30 years, we've really started to find good evidence of this from the field of neuroscience and neurology. And so essentially this is this idea that the brain is a prediction machine is just claiming that the throughout our neural processing, the brain is trying to simulate what's going to happen to the brain and the body next. This is most evident in sensory perception. So the idea here is that your previous experiences and the kind of context in which you find yourself will help to shape the way the brain processes sensory information. And this is happening all the time, but it's especially true when you find yourself in an ambiguous scene. So if you're driving and it's foggy, your brain is helping to kind of fill in the gaps based on what it's expecting to see, to kind of sharpen the images so that it's just a bit more understandable, a bit more meaningful what you're experiencing. In general, those predictions are like hugely accurate, and we don't notice when we make mistakes, but sometimes they can be quite erroneous. And one example from the scientific literature is when scientists asked a bunch of students to listen to a recording of white noise, and they told them that the white noise might contain a recording, a very faint recording of Bing Crosby singing White Christmas. Now, the truth was that there wasn't a recording of Bing Crosby at all, but about 30% of the students reported hearing that song. Their brain, because of that expectation, was actually reshaping the sensory data so that they did hear it. And again, we see the same if people look at the kind of white noise that you might see on an untuned television and tell them that they'll start seeing faces there, then about a third of the time people report seeing a kind of faint face within that white noise. What's even more amazing is that you can look at the brain activity when they're doing that, and it's almost virtually indistinguishable from when the people are actually looking at faces or when they're actually listening to a recording of Bing Crosby. So the brain really is starting to respond as if the sensory information is right there in front of it. So these are kind of hallucinations, but they feel incredibly real. There's no real way of knowing whether it is a hallucination or not. And that's so relevant for all of the other expectation effects, in fact, because the brain isn't just shaping the sensory data based on its expectations. It's also then altering things like the release of hormones, the circulatory system, how that's responding to events. It's kind of helping to fine-tune all of these so that we're best prepared for the situation that it thinks we're going to face in the next few seconds or minutes.
Is this what you term at one point in chapter one, the brain creating unconscious inference?
Yeah, that's exactly it. So, I mean, there's lots of different terms for this. Unconscious inference is what it used to be called historically. Now we talk about predictive processing, but it really means exactly the same thing, that the brain's using all of its experiences from the past to try to infer what's going to happen in the future and then to adjust its state accordingly.
In this chapter, I was especially fascinated with some of what you had to say about phobias and how when somebody is experiencing a phobia such as, well, I think arachnophobia, fear of spiders, is one of them that you specifically mention. And you also talk in this portion of the book about social anxieties of one kind or another, that in many cases the way we are perceiving the world around us, and specifically that which causes this fear, the way we are perceiving that, I mean in terms of actually seeing it or hearing it, will not in fact be, correct. It will be in some way exaggerated for whatever reason, which only, of course, heightens that fear. Tell our listeners more about what I'm talking about here.
So, I mean, this, it's very similar, actually, to the those participants I just mentioned who were kind of hallucinating the sound of Bing Crosby, or who were seeing the faces in the untuned television screens when there were no faces. It's just the expectations shaping the perception. And the idea here with the phobias is that if you have an arachnophobia and you're terrified of spiders, then the brain actually reshapes its sensory processing so that the spider looks much bigger and it looks as if it's moving much faster. So these people really do report seeing the spiders as being vastly bigger than they really are when they have to estimate their size. Similarly, if someone's got a fear of heights, they'll overestimate how far it is to the ground. I think there's good evolutionary reasons for that. If you're really scared of something, it actually really helps for the brain to kind of make it as salient and scary as possible so that you can avoid the potentially dangerous situation. But the problem here is that actually most spiders aren't dangerous. And similarly, with the fear of heights, actually, if you're on an escalator, you're not going to fall off the escalator and you're going to be fine without that level of fear. With the social anxieties, what we see is when people, really scared of hostility, that their brain actually starts to make the people around them seem more hostile. So if they just have a neutral expression on their face, the brain will kind of process that expression in a way that makes it look more hostile. So it might look like a frown, it might look like a grimace, it looks scarier. In all these cases, you want to recalibrate that predictive processing. You want to find some way to kind of change it so that you start to see the world the way it really is rather than this kind of subjectively dark and dangerous place. And there are ways to do that. There's good evidence that actually exposure therapy for things like arachnophobia, the exposure therapy can actually help to recalibrate those expectations. So you reduce this perceptual bias and you start to see the spiders the way they really are rather than being these kind of huge, terrifying beasts.
Right.
The same goes for a fear of heights. People can learn to become much more accurate in the way they perceive them. And then that's associated with a reduction in their fear.
One thing that I'd not really stopped to think about is when you say this about what at one point you call biased processing. You say biased processing can have real behavioral consequences, leading you to avoid the very situations that could help to realign the brain's predictions. In other words, this can very easily end up being kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy of one kind or another, and where we end up actively avoiding that which would ultimately be beneficial to us in terms of kind of sorting out what's going on and sorting out the way in which our eyes or ears or whatever are leading us to, in a sense, misinterpret the world and misinterpret its threats.
Yeah, that's exactly the way I see it, is that it becomes this kind of vicious cycle. You know, if you're scared of spiders and you always avoid them, so you don't really get the information you need to accurately estimate how big they are, then the perceptual bias is actually going to kind of get worse and worse, or at least you're not going to correct it. Similarly, you know, I think with the social anxieties, if you see the people around you looking hostile towards you, then you're less likely to have a friendly interaction with them yourself, which might help you to recalibrate that expectation and help you to understand that actually most of these people, you know, haven't even noticed you probably, and if they have, they're not thinking bad things about you. So that's where things like cognitive behavioral therapy, I think, can help to realign those predictions and expectations. And, you know, just in general, I think actually the findings of the expectation effect are, you know, very much in line with the understanding that therapists have of the way that things like cognitive behavioral therapy can help people, because you're really just helping the client or helping the patient to kind of go out and experience it, the things that they're scared of, in a kind of controlled setting and in a way that can help them to just recalibrate their thinking.
At some point in this portion of the book, you make reference to the brain's inherent subjectivity, and that's a really interesting notion, and particularly in a book that is so scientifically based, that kind of flies in the face of what we often like to think of as that a brain that is functioning well, where you are thinking clearly and thinking rationally, we don't often think about how there is probably an unexpected level of subjectivity at the heart of even our highest brain function.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I think I say something like, you know, we say seeing is believing, but actually believing is seeing. And, you know, that is definitely one of the consequences of the brain being a prediction machine, is that especially in situations where there's room for ambiguity, our expectations are going to shape our perception. And what you have is that two different people coming with two different expectations could have two very different experiences of what they're perceiving. I think we see that a lot with, you know, tales of the paranormal. So, you know, when people claim to have heard like a kind of ghost in a kind of electronic recording, for example, on the radio or something, or if, you know, if someone claims to have seen a ghost in a kind of in the clouds or in a cloud of smoke, you know, that's their expectations shaping what they've seen. And then, you know, they can feel absolutely certain of what they've seen, but it's actually a product of their predictions. But I think actually just in so many other situations, this is really important. So in sports, for example, you know, when in tennis, if someone's making a call of whether the ball was in or out of the court, you know, that's happening so quickly, the brain isn't necessarily receiving enough information to make an objective call, and that's when expectations will come into play. So one player might have seen it in, the other player might have seen it out. The fact is that neither of the players are lying. It's just because of this inherent subjectivity in our perception that they're both reporting different things.
We're speaking with David Robson about his book, The Expectation Effect, How Your Mindset Can Change Your World. We've already talked a fair amount about the placebo effect, so I don't think we need to revisit it again at any great length, but I do want to say chapter 2 of your book, titled A Pious Fraud, which is borrowing, I think, words of our third president, Thomas Jefferson, goes into some really interesting detail about the placebo effect. One thing I would love to have you just underscore is an intriguing turn of phrase at one point in this chapter, in which you talk about the brain having its own inner pharmacy, its own inner pharmacy. And I think you're talking here about the way in which the brain has an amazing capacity to, in a sense, kind of manage various substances, in a sense, sort of simultaneously. Can you just say a word about the brain being in or having its own inner pharmacy?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I think the most solid and the kind of oldest finding here was when scientists were looking at the causes of placebo analgesia. So that's when you receive a placebo pill thinking it's a painkiller and experience often quite astonishing levels of pain relief. Now, there are various ways that you can test this, but one of the most ingenious experiments looked at patients who should have been taking kind of morphine for an injury, or surgery. And what they did was they, instead of giving them the morphine, they gave them a placebo alongside a certain chemical that acts as an antagonist for opioids in the brain. So it actually blocks the signaling. It blocks the signaling that would normally lead to the pain relief from an opioid drug like morphine. Now, what was amazing here was that even though the patients weren't receiving morphine, they were receiving the placebo painkiller, that the this chemical, naloxone, actually blocked the pain relief from that placebo. So even though the participants were expecting to experience pain relief, in this case, they didn't experience it. And so that suggested that actually the same signaling, the opioid signaling, was involved in the pain relief from the placebo, as the same mechanism as you actually saw with the real drug. And then further studies have, used brain scans to kind of look at this signaling in more detail. And they do find actually that when people receive the placebo painkiller, that the placebo painkiller seems to be triggering the release of these opioids. So it's really producing this kind of physiological effect that resembles the actual drug. Hmm. So that's one example of the way the brain has this kind of inner pharmacy. But there are many others. We can see, for example, when patients are receiving a placebo for a Parkinson's drug, that actually they see similarly pronounced changes in the dopamine signaling within the brain. So it seems that actually even there, the placebos are helping to kind of tap the brain's inner stores of dopamine to help to relieve the symptoms. So I think that's quite robust now. I would just say that there's a chance that, say, this talk of the inner pharmacy could lead some people to believe that the brain and the body has automatically everything it needs to cure every disease. And, that's not the case. This is really a case where we do have to set kind of boundaries on what we think the placebo effect can achieve.
Right.
But for certain problems, especially pain relief, especially for helping the symptoms of Parkinson's disease, we do know that actually the placebo effect can be clinically significant. And, doctors are really hoping that they will be able to use this effect practically in the future to improve patients' experiences. Mm.
I also wanted to ask you about a really intriguing turn of phrase in this chapter where you say that honest strategies to have patient expectations managed can be should be a really essential element of evidence-based medicine. I was just so struck by that, the presence of the word honesty, because I think for a lot of us with an incomplete or imperfect understanding of placebos and how they are used, there just sort of seems like there's something inherently dishonest about what we're talking about here. And I think it's very intriguing to think about how this can be talked about and applied to people's lives in honest fashion. Can you talk about that, the kind of honesty you're talking about?
Yeah, so this is really new research and really exciting research that has shown that actually we don't need that dishonesty, that deception that had been associated with the placebo effect. So when Jefferson had called it a pious fraud, it doesn't need to be a fraud at all. I'll give just a couple of examples. One is the increased use of open-label placebos. So this is where you give patients a big jar of pills that are clearly labeled placebos. There might be orange pills and it'll say placebo, take twice a day. What the researchers found was that when they explained to people the mechanisms of the placebo effect and how the mind can actually help to reduce pain, through this kind of inner pharmacy, and then gave people these open-labeled placebos, that they actually did experience a really high level of pain relief, about a 30% reduction in their symptoms, which is really the threshold for clinical significance. So that's quite astonishing. And what it seems is that by educating people about the expectation effect, you're already helping to raise their expectations of what relief they'll be feeling. So they don't need the deceptive element of the placebo anymore. They can actually just understand the scientific facts, and that's enough to change their mindset and then to change their physiology. It's really astonishing, and I think so hopeful for ways that you could help to wean people off of opioid drugs to prevent addiction. That's really what the researchers are now looking at, is, you know, how maybe people will need to take some real painkillers to start with, but then can you help them to then move over to these open-label placebos, so they still experience pain relief, but they're not receiving the addictive chemicals.
The balance of your book explores an array of ways in which this understanding of our expectations and their significance can have very tangible and significant consequences in all kinds of different areas of our life. And we by no means have time to explore them all. I think we have to leave that to our listeners to explore when they get your book. But let's touch on a couple of them. And one of them that intrigued me the most was the fifth chapter of your book, which is titled How to Take the Pain Out of Exercise, in which you talk, among other things, about invisible exercise. And this actually draws back to one of the first scientific studies that you talk about at the very outset of the book, in which the activities in which we engage on a daily basis, how we view them and what we expect from them, can have a huge bearing on how physically healthy we are. Tell our listeners what I'm talking about there.
Yeah, I mean, this is a, you know, like iconic study now that came from Harvard University. And the researchers visited seven different hotels. And for half of the hotels, for I think it was four of the hotels, they just gave a kind of workshop for the cleaners who were cleaning the rooms. And they just pointed out that actually the work they were doing counted as physical exercise. You know, it was the equivalent of going to the gym. They told them how many calories they were burning when they were vacuuming the carpets or when they were cleaning the windows, moving the furniture. You know, it was quite a good workout and easily met the recommended levels of exercise for set by the U.S. Surgeon in Chief. And what they found was that a month later, through this reinterpretation of their work as exercise, that they actually started to see some of the health benefits that you'd normally expect from people who've taken up a new exercise regime. So they showed reduced blood pressure, and they even lost a bit of weight as a result of this changed interpretation of their work, even though they hadn't actually changed their physical activity at all. Now, that was only one study, but follow-up studies have then looked at this in longitudinal samples, so following people over many years of their lives. And what they found was that the people's perceptions of their exercise and their physical activity, whether they think they're doing more or less than the average person, can predict things like the risk of cardiovascular disease and death in the long term. And the researchers controlled for the actual level of physical exercise that these people were doing and found that even then the perceptions of exercise seem to have a big impact on their overall health. So that's just another line of evidence that shows that actually the way we perceive our activities can be really important in shaping their health benefits.
And you explore much of this in other areas of life, including the food we eat and how our expectations, for instance, about given foods, that has a whole lot to do with how our body will take it in and so on. And I could go on and on. But I want to, since time is almost gone, I want to leap to the end of the book when you sum everything up in such interesting fashion and give a couple of parting words of advice in terms of helping people to make tangible choices and regarding expectations. And I should say every chapter ends with very tangible suggestions. But at the very end of the book, in a sense, your parting thought to the reader is be kind to yourself. That I did not expect. Explain why it is important for us to be kind to ourselves, even as we are thinking about these exciting possibilities regarding our expectations.
I mean, it's just so important to not beat ourselves up for kind of the small failures that we have in our lives. I think there's so much robust evidence showing that actually the more self-critical we are, the harder we find it to make positive personal change in our lives. It's just so demotivating, it increases our stress levels. You know, it really is so counterproductive. So the research now, and there's a huge body of research on this concept of self-compassion, and it really just shows that self-compassion is itself good for our health. You know, it reduces the levels of inflammation in the body that can lead to illness and disease. But independently of that, it also just really helps us to make positive changes to our lifestyle. And this includes, I think, changes to our expectations. It means that it's easier for us to apply the expectation effect. And I think alongside that, you know, if you're struggling with something, what's really helpful is to just take a step outside of yourself and imagine that you're advising a friend rather than kind of talking to yourself. Because the chances are, if you're a kind person, you're going to be much kinder to your friend than you are to yourself. You're going to be much more encouraging and positive. And that can just help you to see your situation a bit more objectively. And just to give a couple of examples, you know, within the book, I talk about how our expectations and beliefs about our own fitness can shape how hard a workout is. So, you know, if you're kind of working out on a treadmill and you're finding it hard, you're finding it difficult, you know, you're feeling out of breath and your limbs are aching, and you're telling yourself, oh, you know, you're, you know, like my partner actually, he tells himself, you know, oh, you know, you're lazy, you're just automatically bad at exercise, you're never going to get better. You know, that's not the kind of mindset you want. And what I tell him to do is to just try to imagine that he was advising, like, me or one of his friends. You know, you wouldn't stand beside the treadmill telling your friend, like, you're a failure, you're never going to do this. You'd be telling them something positive about, you know, how actually, you know, they're finding it hard, but they can manage to do the exercise, and that the strain itself is helping them to become fitter. You know, you'd automatically change your mindset in that way. And that's why I think it's so helpful for us to do this, to, if you try to, like, just remove that self-criticism by imagining that you're talking to someone else, that can automatically help you to reset your expectations.
The book, again, is The Expectation Effect: How Your Mindset Can Change Your World, published by Henry Holt & Company, and the author, David Robson. David Robson, thank you so much for giving the world this wonderful book. I enjoyed it so much, learned so much from it, and I hope many people will seek it out. Thank you for making time for The Morning Show in your busy life, and best wishes to you.
It's absolutely my pleasure. Thank you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, in a departure from our published schedule, I am looking forward to welcoming into our studios Amir Hussein, who is a special guest of Carthage College for a special interfaith event that's going on in Kenosha this weekend. He'll be talking on the topic of religion in our modern world and the importance of building bridges.